This sermon was delivered at Grand Avenue Baptist Church, a gospel-centered church in Ames, Iowa. Hear more sermons and learn more about Grand Avenue at gabcames.org.
My last lesson for the term, this will be my last entry in our apologetics series here this semester. I will have a few others doing the balance of it. So far, it's been a fun challenge for me. Hopefully, it's been somewhat helpful for you all. So this will close out kind of the basic framework that I set up those several weeks back of the kind of three different methods of arguing essentially for the reality of God, for the existence of God. And as we kind of pull on that thread, we'll start to get into the attributes of God as well, not the path that we went down, but that's just kind of the trajectory we could have gone. Okay, so today, what's our last kind of method that we're going to be digging into? Inductive approach to apologetics. Inductive. Another label I've given for it is the evidential or evidentialist method of apologetics. So I want to. What were the three that we've touched on? What were the three methods? Who remembers those? Yeah. Inductive, deductive, and presuppositional. And intuitive could be another name for that third one. So we'll be doing inductive today. So I want to start with just kind of a caveat, something on the danger of doing inductive arguments. And this is something, a part of the reason of why I wanted to do this third, why I wanted to do the other two before getting here, because if we start here, and this is probably the inductive method is probably what you're going to find in most kind of modern approaches to apologetics. If you're going to see some kind of an apologetics ministry, generally it's going to be mostly the inductive method, and with good reason. I think it's and we saw this in Boyce two weeks ago when we were looking at the deductive. It's somewhat easier to grasp it, as an argument. It's just easier to follow. Here's the point I'm trying to make. But the danger that comes with it is basically it can kind of give too much ground to unbelief, and if you're not careful, kind of setting up reason as basically this neutral meeting space between belief and unbelief. That kind of unbeliever and believer alike can approach reason with kind of equal claim on just human reasoning. And so, again, the inductive method, sometimes some folks will kind of positively argue for that, that secular perspective, Christian perspective, both can support the fact of human reasoning equally well, but often just by leaving it unsaid, will kind of implicitly support that. But that's something that should be noted, that just we shouldn't grant that. We shouldn't grant that. And that's why we want to start with the intuitive approach and the deductive approach, and last coming to the inductive approach. So basically two halves to this problem, two halves to the problem of reason in apologetics, two halves to just this concept of reason between worldviews. So the first is at the worldview level, just the problem at the worldview level. So to put it bluntly, your first blank there, it just says worldview level on secularism, reason is impossible. Reason, if it is what we think it is, on secular commitments is not possible. And so the way that I would say, you know, that reason is not a kind of public meeting square where the Christian and the non-Christian can meet to debate things equally outside of each of their homes. Reason is the Christianity mansion fireplace room, right? The problem is that you can only do reason because Christianity is true. Reasoning only works because secularism is wrong. If the non-believer proves his point, he proves that reasoning is impossible. He reasons that reason is impossible. That no one can. And that's the idea. If secularism is true, reasoning is impossible. Because secularism is not true, you can have reasonable dialogue. You can reason. That's the idea. And that echoes back to the kind of intuitive approach on the front end. So C.S. Lewis, his quote digs into this. I want to read his quote, and then I'll kind of go back, read it again, and kind of explain it a little bit. So I think he hits this just well and quite precisely. So I'll just read it, and then I'll come back and explain it. He says, "The belief in such a supernatural reality itself," God, can neither be proved nor disproved by experience. The arguments for its existence are metaphysical, and to me, conclusive. They turn on the fact that even to think and act in the natural world, we have to assume something beyond it, and even assume that we partly belong to that something. In order to think, we must claim for our own reasoning a validity which is not credible if our own thought is merely a function of our brain, and our brain's a byproduct of irrational physical processes. In order to act above the level of mere impulse, we must claim a similar validity to our judgments of good and evil. In both cases, we get the same disquieting result. The concept of nature itself is one we have reached only by only tacitly by claiming a sort of supernatural status for ourselves. So, who could summarize that? Who could take a stab at summarizing what he's saying? What's his argument there? Yeah, Andy, go ahead. Yeah, that's right. That's good. Yeah, Jack?
I guess it also presumes that the rational can come out of the irrational. The rational can spawn out of the irrational. Versus the Christian view, the rational always existed.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, so basically the idea is, imagine a wildly complex mesh of dominoes, right? Trillions upon trillions of not just tipping over, but like crossing and interactions, incredibly complicated. How complicated does it need to be to have thought? How many kind of interactions of the dominoes must there be for there to be rational thought? That's an absurd question. No, it's impossible, right? No matter how many dominoes you can have, it's always just cause and effect. And if your brain, if thought is just a product of chemicals and electrical signals, it's not fundamentally different than a bunch of dominoes knocking over each other. Does that make sense? If secularism is true, that kind of this mechanistic cause and effect is all there is, then our thoughts are no more real than kind of the final design of the dominoes when they tip over. Does that make sense? There has to be something above the cause and effect to actually have reason, to actually be thought. More or less make sense? I'd go back to kind of the intuitive arguments and basically kind of walk through the, okay, so that means your free will is an illusion, that means that good and evil is an illusion, that means that meaning is an illusion, and basically you boil it down to you are no more complicated, are no more meaningful than a arbitrarily set up series of dominoes. And if someone says, I accept, then that's the end of the conversation. It frankly is, right? Where it's just like, we can't go further. If you're willing to say, I am nothing more than cause and effect, then that's the end of the conversation. And basically your appeal then becomes emotional, and then you say, that's not true. You know that's not true. All of your most cherished beliefs testify that's not true. Right? And that then becomes the appeal. Okay. So that just kind of as an aside before we jump into these. Reason is not a neutral public square that we meet for debate. Reason is the fireplace room in the Christian mansion. The secularist problem is that he is trying to squat in the Christian mansion and steal our stuff, thought, reason, free will, morality, all while pretending it's public property. He's welcome to keep it all, but he has to move in and get right with Dad, right? Or he has to leave it and go live in his own house. That's the idea. That's the idea. If he proves secularism is true, then he has proven that proofs are impossible. Okay, so then the personal level of this issue as well is that repentance, this is your next blank, repentance comes before knowledge of the truth. Maybe not the best way to state that. What I mean there is that there is a spiritual problem propping up the intellectual problem. There's a spiritual problem that kind of lends its support to the intellectual problem, right? You can attack the intellectual problem, and you should, but until the spiritual problem is solved, there's always going to be that intellectual problem sitting up. Does that make sense? So there's repentance is needed to actually come to a full acceptance of the knowledge of the truth. Romans 1:21, although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. So out of a refusal to honor God, there's a darkening of the heart, of the mind. And 2 Timothy 2:25, how does this problem get solved? So Paul is telling Timothy that pastors and leaders need to correct their opponents with gentleness. And then he adds this caveat, God may perhaps grant them repentance, leading to a knowledge of the truth. The spiritual problem needs to be knocked out before the intellectual problem can fully and finally be dealt with. So two problems we need to avoid, or I guess four principles for your blanks. Now, the first are the two ditches, I suppose. So don't overestimate the role of reason. As we're thinking about inductive arguments, don't overestimate the role of reason. It's a useful tool. It needs to be used. There's a way that you can kind of use the arguments I've been saying to kind of just not reason with non-believers, but we should, right? Kind of the error would be to say, because secularism can't support reason, then reason is unhelpful in apologetics. But because they're wrong, reason is helpful. So don't overestimate the role of reason, but on the other side, don't underestimate the role of reason. Don't underestimate the role of reason. Many people are genuinely tripped up by genuine, rational, and logical problems, and answering a few key objections or laying down a few key arguments can be genuinely helpful in the process of conversion. So don't underestimate the role of reason. Goal is to make unbelief uncomfortable. Again, for Jack's hypothetical person who just says, I believe all that, I want to be a consistent secularist. Again, this is Stephen Hawking saying free will is basically an illusion. The goal is to make unbelief uncomfortable. You don't really believe that. All of your decisions were not real decisions. All of your values are fake. All of your loves are an illusion. All of your judgments are illusions, right? You really believe that? Make unbelief uncomfortable. And then also, yeah, back to what I said earlier on, focus on one objection or argument at a time. Focus on one objection or argument at a time. Often, when anyone, but especially in these conversations, when someone, their argument starts to get uncomfortable, their objection starts to get dealt with, they'll kind of quickly pivot to something else, often somewhat unrelated. And so because that's a spiritual problem, there's a spiritual problem undergirding the intellectual problem. And so when one intellectual problem kind of gets worn thin, they just kind of replace it with another little intellectual meat shield. Right? And so the idea is, no, let's finish this conversation. We'll move to that, but let's finish this conversation, deal with this issue, and then we'll move on to the next. Force a conclusion to the best of your ability. Stay focused. Okay, moving into inductive arguments. Basically, what's going on here, it's probably oversimplifying to say, but in general, what we're going to try to do is reason from a design to a designer. To reason from kind of apparent, evident design in the world around us to a designer. This famously, so you're blank, there is design. If there is design, there must be a designer. One of the kind of famous examples of or explanations of this is the idea that if you are out for a hike in the mountains, this comes from a gentleman named William Paley from a couple hundred years ago. If you're out for a walk in the mountains and you're in the field and all of a sudden you find a wristwatch lying there in the field and you pick it up, you know somebody designed this. Somebody made this. No part of you goes, wow, it's amazing that this developed naturally. What a marvel, right? There's obvious design in the thing, and so you've never met the guy. You have no reason to believe that he's even still alive, but you know this thing is not self-explanatory. This thing is not from itself. So he says the same, if we can prove similar design in nature, then nature cannot be self-explanatory. That's a high-level idea. So three ways to account for complexity, and complexity is more or less a kind of a neutral term that you want that is helpful to use to basically say, hey, we agree that this thing is complex. The question is it designed or not designed, right? So three ways to account for complexity: chance, that's your blank, natural law, and design. Chance, natural law, and design. So chance, right? You spill a bunch of marbles on the table. It's a complex arrangement, but that's just kind of chance. It just bounces around, right? Natural law, you can think of something like a salt crystal. Like if you look at like how salt crystals form, or pretty much any crystal forms, there's a structure there that's really intricate, that's really complex. And yet, that's just basically because of the way that the molecules are shaped, that's kind of how it forms out. So you can say, okay, that's complex, but that kind of can be accounted for more or less by natural law. And then, so then the third question is, if we can eliminate chance as an explanation, if we can eliminate natural law as an explanation, what remains then is design. Someone designed this. Go for it. Yeah, you can go down that rabbit trail. So the idea of chance, is chance really real? Pretty much any consistent worldview is going to eliminate chance, because either it's just natural law that we don't understand, right? It's just wildly, even the marbles, right? They're there because of how they bounced off each other, right? And that could be infinite intelligence could trace that out beforehand. But basically then they would just say, well, that's just natural law, right? So to some degree, natural law, right, chance more or less collapses into natural law that we just don't see the rhyme or reason for. Yep. Okay, so then going from that, so you have design. How do you identify design? So a gentleman named William Dembski, more recent, in a work called The Design Inference, gives three kind of criteria, there it is, criteria for determining whether complexity is designed or not designed. So his three criteria are this. It's the first is contingency. So it's his use of the term. I would reserve it for the deductive stuff that we talked about before, but he uses the word contingency. That's fine. How I would say that is basically non-self-explanatory, right? Whatever this thing is, it can't just, it isn't that way from its own self. So you look at kind of a tree comes out of an acorn, that's complex. You can kind of go, well, that's kind of self-explanatory. That's just what oak trees do, right? But if you find an oak tree upside down, still with green leaves on a beach, there's a certain sense where, okay, that's not self-explanatory. There's some other reason that this tree is upside down, right? Does that make sense? The difference between kind of self-explanatory, not self-explanatory. There's a ball at the top of a hill, very precariously rested. It shouldn't be at the top of the hill, it should be the bottom of the hill. That's not self-explanatory, right? Now, that's not design, right? Could be both of those. A big gust of wind could have done either of those things, right? So you need more than contingency, but that's kind of a necessary component. Again, the salt crystal, it's somewhat self-explanatory of just the nature of how the molecules are shaped. So the second one is complexity. Complexity. Basically saying many and interdependent factors to be accounted for. It's a highly improbable situation. So complexity starts to come up where it's not just one tree. It's like there's 17 trees all upside down, and they seem to be in some kind of a pattern. That there's something complex going on, or there's not just one ball at the top of the hill. There's lots of different balls, and you know there's a little teepee up there, and you're kind of like, well, the wind could have blown all that stuff, but there's a lot of factors to be explained. So complexity, contingency, basically you could just have one thing to explain. Complexity, there's all of a sudden now you have lots of things that are kind of working together that need to be explained kind of at the same time. You're looking for one explanation for all of these things. Again, if it's just a bunch of trees on a beach, you could say, well, it's just a really strong gust of wind, right? So still, you're not at design yet. So then you get to specificity. Specificity. The various factors work together to accomplish some apparent purpose. Some apparent purpose. So there's a bunch of trees uprooted on the beach, and 12 of them form a wall, and then, you know, 10 of them on the inside form a little hut. You look at that and you go, okay, that looks like there's a purpose involved, right? So there's contingency, there's complexity, but then you get a specificity, and you go, it seems like if I took two of those trees away, this what seems like a wall wouldn't be a wall anymore, right? So there's a certain sense where there's an apparent purpose to the interrelation of the things to be explained. More or less tracking. Make sense so far? So how are we determining if something is designed, right? Or again, you know, you have a monkey slapping away at a typewriter, you might get a really complex result of symbols on the page, right? But then if you look at it and you start to, and you realize that, man, this is a sustained reflection on the virtues of eating bugs off your buddy's back, right, then you know that there must be some design in this. This isn't just the monkey slapping away arbitrarily, right? There was design in this thing. Yeah. So time doesn't have any causal power behind it. So if a monkey is slapping a keyboard for 10 minutes or a monkey is slapping a keyboard for 10,000 years, there's no reason that something purposive is going to emerge out of that just because it's taking longer time. And so I think that's a common objection that you would hear, but I think it's generally a smokescreen where they haven't thought through, basically that would only make sense if somehow like a production of a certain pattern eliminates that pattern. And so you're slowly whittling down to like, we can no longer do that random slapping. We have to do this random slapping. And eventually we're going to get to the random slappings that look meaningful. When in reality, you can just have lots of random slappings forever and never get any design. As soon as you get Shakespeare, you recognize this is not random. This is simply, you cannot reasonably say that this is something that randomly appeared. Andy? Why?
Like, just given what a there is random chance, right? Eventually, those marbles, even just in short term period, you can just shake a box of marbles myself, shake a box of marbles around, and eventually end up on their own side. Just from them fighting with each other, eventually.
So you're saying, like, all the red on one side, all the blue on the other side? That assumes you're building on it, though.
No, like, these things are just randomly scrambled. It's not like, I saw the result, and then I adjusted it out. Because of that. It's just a scramble, and then you can find, oh, words actually being generated by happenstance. So why can't I extend that to it's randomly generated, extend it, give it more time. Eventually, it will send words something by accident. Not because I'm doing it, but changing it, or trying to separate the marbles out of my own. Eventually, given enough time, these things kind of separate. It might land in that.
I don't think that follows. So the marbles, if they're tending towards their own sides, there's something implicit, there's something in those marbles that has different weight values that's going to push them one way or the other.
I'm just saying that they're all neutral.
Scott's excited. Go for it. So let's truck forward. I think we'll look at some of the numbers to kind of talk through plausibility.
Everybody needs to queue up.
Okay. Okay. Fascinating. All right. So let's jump into it. Let's jump into it. I think to some degree there is the plausibility. There is the kind of the plausibility question. Take 8 marbles, take 16 marbles, take 10,000 marbles. We're talking about much smaller numbers than kind of the stuff that we need to be thinking about here. So we'll jump into just three quick topics. This is not my wheelhouse, so I don't have a ton to say about this anyways, so we'll just kind of cruise through. So, but three topics to consider, this kind of three helpful hooks to hang your hat on. The first is cosmic fine-tuning. Basically, you're thinking about here what are called anthropic coincidences. What does anthropic mean? Anybody know? Yeah, pertaining to humanity. Anthropic coincidences. And don't think coincidence like random chances, but think of it like co-incident, things happening together, right? Anthropic things that happen together, have to happen together, that need to be true for human life to exist. So just a couple of examples. The first is electron strength. Here, quoting Stephen Hawking, kind of my buddy in this project. He says, if the electric charge of the electron had been only slightly different, stars would have been unable to burn hydrogen and helium, or else they would not have exploded. It seems clear that there are relatively few ranges of values for the numbers, for the constants, that would allow for the development of any form of intelligent life. Most sets of values would give rise to universes that, although they might be very beautiful, would contain no one able to wonder at that beauty. All right, so he's making the point, if electrons were slightly different, life just couldn't happen within a very small range. Another one that, I mean, I guess you can look into would just be the strength of the strong nuclear force holding atoms together. If it's a little bit stronger, the atom collapses, a little bit weaker, more complex elements can't form. So helpful things to look into there. The next is biological design. Biological design. So basically, quick summary of the argument. There are pervasive features of life that include contingency, complexity, and specificity. These features cannot be accounted for by natural law, chance, or natural selection. Therefore, these features can only be accounted for by design. So that's the structure of the argument. Each of those, of course, would have to be argued. So the big term you're going for here is the idea of irreducible complexity. Irreducible complexity. A man named Michael Behe, in his first book being Darwin's Black Box, basically it goes into kind of the molecular biology, molecular machinery that makes life happen. And basically argues when Darwin was putting forward his idea of how life works, where it came from, his concept of the lowest kind of lowest feature of life would have been something like Jell-O. He had no idea how life actually operated at the lowest levels. And so to him, kind of little tweaks seemed like small little changes without much complexity. Behe argues basically ever since then, we have our understanding of how life actually works has vastly expanded in a way that the theory just can't account for. So he has this idea of irreducible complexity. Basically, there are these machines that simply cannot be developed through natural selection step by step. Basically, each of the parts are required to be in place and functional at once to operate. The example he gives is a mousetrap. Lots of kind of complex parts working together. Each of the individual parts might be able to use it for something, but a mousetrap basically missing one of its parts isn't a functional mousetrap anymore. It's not a slightly less efficient mousetrap. You take away the spring, you just have a flappy little metal piece. Doesn't accomplish anything. It's not a less effective mousetrap. You take away the wood that holds it together, you don't have a mousetrap at all. You take away the little catch that holds the thing down, it's just a thing. So basically, you can't have it's not a function of slow development towards a better thing. It's a complete creation of a new thing where there was no thing in the first place. The example he gives that has kind of become the poster child of this argument is the bacterial flagellum, something we're all very familiar with, I am sure. So he describes it this way. He says, the flagellum is quite literally an outboard motor that some bacteria use to swim. It is a rotary device that, like a motorboat, turns a propeller to push against liquid, moving the bacterium forward in the process. It consists of a number of parts, including a long tail that acts as a propeller, the hook region, which attaches a propeller to the drive shaft, the motor, which uses a flow of acid from the outside of the bacterium to the inside to power the turning, a stator, which keeps the structure stationary in the plane of the membrane while the propeller turns, and bushing material to allow the drive shaft to pike up through the bacterial membrane. basically, again, he's saying if you take away one piece, you don't have a less efficient motor. You don't have a motor. Yes. No, no. So natural selection to operate has to have something to operate on. So that's he expands on that in his other later book, Darwin Devolves. Basically, the idea that natural selection is good at improving what already exists. There's a sense where to get from no little motor for the bacteria to a motor for the bacteria, you can't kind of move. There's no step where you take this process and kind of slowly add new elements and get to a more efficient motor. We'll move on. So that's his argument. There are things designed that you can't kind of slowly build up to. So we get to this. The last thing is biological origins. Biological origins. Where did the first life come from? Does anybody know the term for this? Close. Abiogenesis. Abiogenesis. So A, right, is the Greek negation prefix. So basically this means like lifeless beginning, life from non-life, right? Where does, on the secular theory, where does the first life come from? Where does the first cell come from? So again, the idea is natural selection can only operate on things that already are self-replicating. For there to be any, for natural selection to get off the ground, there has to be something that is self-replicating to have iterations on. So for life to come into being naturalistically, the first cell, the first self-replicating thing, has to jump into being from nothing in one jump, or from basic chemical components. So this means that the entire DNA structure and cellular machinery of the cell, in order to self-replicate, has to come into being with one sudden leap. A good comparison, somebody named Fred Hoyle, has an illustration. I didn't know what he was. Has an illustration that's helpful. Basically, he says imagining this happening is something like imagining a tornado going through a junkyard, and a functional 747 appearing. We're not talking about a small composition of some simple thing. For life to be self-replicating, there's a tremendous amount of complexity that goes into it. A biochemist by the name of Doug Axe. First of all, a great name, must have come out of pro wrestling. But anyways, he's a biochemist now, good for him. So he calculates basically the chance of a random sequence of amino acids forming a relatively small protein to be 1 in 10 to the 74th. So a simple protein forming from basically just kind of simple chemicals on its own being 1 in 10 to the 74th, meaning 10 to the 74th, 74 zeros after the 1. Comparable to, he says, that number is comparable to the chances of randomly picking a single marked atom in a billion galaxies. So that's slim, to say the least. So, and self-replicating life takes a lot more than one protein, to be clear. So there are a couple of counter theories, which I think are interesting on one hand and hilarious on the other. So counter theories, where did life come from? How did life, what's a secular account of where the first life came from? Probably the most popular and the one that a lot of like evolution textbooks are going to have, secular textbooks are going to have these days, basically the kind of lightning in the primordial soup idea, that there was kind of this big pot of chemicals in an early Earth that was struck by lightning and then some amoeba assembled. And so this comes from a 1953 experiment done by scientists Miller and Urey. Basically, they had some gases in a tube based on what they supposed a primitive Earth would have been like. They shocked it with some electricity to stimulate lightning, and then after about a week of that, it produced a couple of simple amino acids. Is that life?
No, dirt.
Not life. So, good point. Taken as evidence, basically... So basically, this was taken as evidence that process could have produced self-replicating life on Earth. It's kind of a lightning bolt striking a pool of junk could have created life. So a couple problems with that. First, it had very, very humble results. So amino acids are not proteins, and proteins are not self-replicating life. So this would be like an experiment showing how kind of naturally occurring phenomenon can produce straight lines on paper, but then claiming that Shakespeare's Hamlet was a product of nature. Lines are not letters. Letters are not words. Words are not Shakespeare. So second, even on an old Earth framework, the experiment was wrong about the chemical makeup of the atmosphere. They didn't include oxygen, and given the secular model, that would have nullified even the little results that they did have. So that's not a very credible option, but that's kind of the probably assumed go-to. Then the next is an idea called directed panspermia. Does anybody know what that is? Go for it. So that would be undirected panspermia. Directed panspermia.
Aliens.
Aliens. And this is like, what's that? So the bigwig guys that think about this, they're kind of like, yeah, the primordial soup doesn't work. So, you know, maybe aliens. Like, I don't know. This is kind of where they go. So Francis Crick, one of the discoverers of the double helix structure of DNA. So no slouch in the biochemistry world. And a committed atheist, he says that the origin of life appears to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions that would have to be satisfied to get it going. And then in a paper of the same name, he suggested the idea of directed panspermia in 1973. Basically the aliens sent life here on a big probe. This is not some rando in a garage. This is Francis Crick. This is a well-educated individual saying this is probably the best explanation. So obvious problems. Where did life come from on their planet, right? We can go down that whole rabbit trail. But it is hilarious, so I appreciate them. Appreciate them for giving me that. So that's basically the idea that where kind of the three hooks you can hang your hat on of where of these kind of arguments from design. We'll end it there. I'll give you the blanks. These are basically kind of high-level arguments against these principles. So the first one is God of the gaps, basically the idea that, you're just trying to explain things that we don't understand by appealing to God. That just isn't valid. We're not saying we don't know how things work, therefore God must have done it. We're saying we actually know how things work a lot better now, and that can't have developed naturally. And even further, you saw Aquinas' argument that this science explains everything thing is not a new objection. Second one is a truism rebuttal. We're basically just saying like, well, yeah, sure, it's improbable that a universe that supports life would come into being, and yet if it didn't, we wouldn't be here to be debating about it. Therefore, it's just kind of a truism that the world happened to work out the way it did. That's a fair point, but not helpful. Basically, they're saying that like, well, there's of all the billion places that arrow could have landed on the side of the barn, you just kind of drew a circle around the one it did happen to land on and say nailed it. It's just not a valid rebuttal because we're still talking about, well, how it's not that it could have landed anywhere. It's that it's been wildly improbable that it landed here in the first place. And the last, again, one of the more kind of respected rebuttals, one of the more respected things is the multiverse theory, that there's an infinite number of universes, which... Yeah, just with the aliens thing, it's just reaching for straws. Like, there's just no reason to believe that. Anyways, that's what we have there, which is kind of like the multiverse of the gaps theory.
Just super quickly, next week I'm teaching, fair warning, there's a book. We're going to touch on this stuff next week and a few other things as well. We're going to move super quickly, but if you have questions about this or like what you're thinking about this week,
great. Thanks, Tim. All right, let me pray for you.